from the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up, a major move in the U.S. Senate yesterday that will facilitate the confirmation of certain presidential nominees. Now, some say the majority leader Mitch McConnell went nuclear. Others say he just returned the Senate to longstanding tradition. We'll see what Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, who chairs the Senate Rules Committee, has to say. Also, the sanctity of human life continues to be a major issue on Capitol Hill as the discharge petition on the Born Alive Abortion Survivor Protection Act became active this week in the House. Also, we saw last week Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced that the administration was closing loopholes on Mexico City policy. What does that look like? We'll talk with Maryland Congressman Dr. Andy Harris a little bit later on Washington Watch. And is there a correlation between increased crime and porous borders? Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNS News, crunches the numbers from the courts. We'll look at that. And finally, a lot happening this week on a host of issues. We'll break them all down with an FRC expert panel later on Washington Watch. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you're on Twitter, it is at T. Perkins. All right. The Hill.com reports that Senate Republicans are going nuclear with a rules change for hundreds of nominations, escalating a war with Democrats over President Trump's picks. Well, you know, they go on to say that after fuming for years over the pace of confirmations, Republicans say the years-long fight will soon come to a head, and the end result will dramatically reduce the amount of time it takes to confirm most nominees, end quote. Well, here to shed light on that story, Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri, who chairs the Senate Rules Committee, also serves on the Appropriations Committee, the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, as well as the Intelligence Committee. Senator Blunt, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Tony, great to be with you again.
All right. The truth lies somewhere in between. Some are saying Mitch McConnell went nuclear. Others are saying this is just returning the Senate to its longstanding tradition on how it deals with nominations. So what has taken place in the Senate?
Well, as you said, I chair the Rules Committee in the Senate, and there are so few rules in the Senate that part of that job is also just kind of the daily operation of the Senate. But the rules part of the job does matter. And, you know, the Senate rules are Senate rules, and there are standing orders that have been added to Senate rules when the rules weren't actually changed, and then precedent. And the precedent part of the rules is something that over time senators have almost always done by a simple majority. It's not really a rules change. It's not really a standing order change. It just simply a majority of the senators say, no, we think the rules need to be interpreted this way, which often means they need to be changed, which is what we did this week. Now, Senator Lankford and I had voted, had drafted, and then we reported out of my committee, the Rules Committee, a standing order that would have been a little more specific than the way we had to do this, but essentially that standing order would have gotten us to the same place, which is just back to where you have a reasonable amount of time for the floor debate if a floor debate is insisted on. And Democrats under this president have been insisting on that 30 hours of floor time available for almost all the president's nominees, which just means you can't get to anything else. And part of it was to slow the president down in his effort to take over the government that people elected him to be the president of, to be the chief executive of. And another part was it just uses up that valuable floor time, particularly in the first year of a presidency that you never get back. And so, Tony, we actually voted a similar bill out of the Rules Committee last Congress, but there are only 51 Republicans, and all 51 of those Republicans, including me, were here. I was willing to make this change in the last Congress, but we couldn't quite get to the 51 of us that it would take to make that change. And so we're back to where the Democrats can no longer abuse the rules, abuse the protections of the minority in a way that makes it impossible for the president to take over the government or impossible for us to put young, healthy, social constitutional conservatives on the courts, and of course that lifetime appointment is the most important appointment of all. Those still take 30 hours for the circuit courts and the Court of Appeals, but district courts and the other jobs that the president needs to fill can be done in something much more like the tradition of the Senate, which was not to use the filibuster ever, really until 2003, to slow down nominations.
So for those who, I mean, this is kind of inside baseball, but the practical outcome here is that people have been wondering, you know, President Trump was elected 2 years ago, but yet we still see a lot of vacancies in many government spots. We don't see his policies being implemented throughout the federal government. The reason for that is that, in essence, what we have the minority doing in the Senate is trying to run out the clock, just kind of sitting on the ball, trying to keep the Republicans from being able to move through these nominations with a majority vote. We're not trying to do an in run here. It's just allowing them an up or down vote on the Senate floor without eating up all the time that the Senate has to operate. Is that in essence, a layman's description of
that,
what
that is exactly place? Right. And of course, of the time that would be set, the Democrats under the old rules were able to insist be set aside. Almost none of that time was ever used to actually talk about the nominee. And so it just kept us from getting to anything else. Of that 30 hours, seldom was an hour used. On the Attorney General of the United States, Bill Barr, who would still have 30 hours, by the way, cabinet members would right. still have the potential for 30 hours of debate. But even for Bill Barr, it was less than 4 hours of that 30 hours left. On some of the circuit judges that and district judges that they insisted on 30 hours on, no time was used. Literally zero time was used, often less than 5 minutes of that 30 hours would be used to talk about the nominee. Remember, this is a nominee who's gone through the background check, who's presented whatever background information they needed to. They've been questioned by the appropriate committee. That committee had to vote to send them to the floor, and then the job of the senators on the floor is to either confirm them or say, no, there's a reason we don't think we want this person to do that job, and move on. When Ronald Reagan was president, the average amount of time it took from the time you came out of committee until you were voted on and then able to take your job if you were approved was 5 days. Under President Trump, it was 55 days. And 124 people, most of whom had been out of the committee for over a year, had to be sent back to the White House at the end of the last conference. And essentially, it's start the process over again.
So, I mean, this is just reflective, unfortunately, of the partisan divide that is in the country currently, where you just have really obstructionist tactics taking place to keep this president from carrying out the mandate that the American people gave him in the election. Senator, well, let me ask you this question, because this is one of those, there were some even on the right that were opposed to this. They thought, well, you know, this is changing the Senate precedent. It could open the door to other things. Some have said, well, this could open the door to changing the filibuster for legislation, which has long protected the minority views. What do you say to that?
Well, I think that is not the case. I mean, there's a chance that the Senate could always head in that direction, but senators should know that there is a chance if you're in the majority today, you're going to be in the minority pretty quickly after that. We wrote a piece of legislation that's largely reflected in what we did that we thought we could live with if we were in the minority, and thought that, frankly, any president deserves the opportunity to at least have their nominees voted on. And so that's really where we are here for from 1789, really until 2003, when President George W. Bush nominated Miguel Estrada to the D.C. Circuit Court three different times and was stopped by procedural votes three different times. From 1789 until 2003, procedural obstacles were just not put in the way of presidential nominees. When Clarence Thomas was voted on, the vote was 52-48 with not a single person suggesting that there should be a procedural obstacle of 60, because that just was not the tradition of the country. I think the argument is strong here that what we've really done is take the nomination process back to where it had always been. I think you could argue that actually helps protect the other process, because people are always upset about Senate rules, and this was a rule that was particularly easy to be upset about. You know, and by the way, Tony, when we had these debates, the debates that really didn't have any time used for the debate, 48% of all the people that had that 30 hours of debate required got 60 votes, 33% got 70 votes, 13% got 90 votes or more. And so these were clearly just obstruction tactics. They were not tactics that had anything to do with the nominee. It was trying to keep the nominee from getting the job, not that there was an argument that the nominee shouldn't be able to do the job.
Right. Just, again, trying to run the clock out on this administration. I mean, because I looked at the projections. I was up at the White House a while back talking with, I forget which office there, but their projections for all of the nominees in the pipeline at the pace we were at, it would be like 2023 before they were all confirmed.
And that's for one term.
Exactly.
Like, you know, it's 10 years, almost 10 years of just to get one term's worth of people confirmed. In the three previous presidencies in the first 2 years, there'd been a total of 24 times that every majority leader, whether it was President Obama, President Bush, or President Clinton, 24 times total had to file to have a cloture vote to get to a nominee. Senator McConnell had to file 128 times to get that many of President Trump's nominees confirmed and on the job. And, you know, the good news is that included two Supreme Court judges. Right. It included dozens of circuit judges. We're changing the judiciary. That had to be, I think that was our appropriate priority. But the expense of doing that with these obstruction tactics was that the underlying jobs in the government, the jobs that were below the secretary of the various cabinet members, have gone unfilled at a rate that is really unfortunate. And we're now going to be able to do something about that. And
so
again,
that
let me say
change.
This too. We were ready to do it last year. We just couldn't quite get 51 of our Republican colleagues to agree that they were ready to take that step. But 2 years of bad behavior led 51 of the 53 Republicans in the Senate today to the place that we'd rather do this the other way, but this has to be changed, and we're ready to change it.
Well, you now have the tools in place to move forward. So hopefully we'll see a lot of this backlog will be reduced as we see many of these.
We confirmed two people today with 2 hours of debate that would have taken 30 hours of debate each before.
Well, very good. Senator Roy Blunt, as always, great to have you on the program, and hope you have a great weekend.
Great to talk to you, and look forward to being with you again soon.
All right. Missouri Senator Roy Blunt, chairman of the Senate Rules Committee. So, you know, a lot of people have been talking about this. Why can't the president get his people on? Well, they get the votes, as you just said. They get the 51 votes. It's just they've been dragging their feet, trying to run the clock out on the Trump administration by using delaying tactics. That's now changed, at least on district courts, ambassadorships, and sub-cabinet-level positions. Okay, don't go away. Dr. Andy Harris is with us next. We're back after this.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
Happy birthday to you.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Tony Perkins. So glad to have you with us. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you happen to be on Twitter, it's at T Perkins. All right, the sanctity of life has been at the forefront this week on Capitol Hill with the discharge petition on the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, reaching maturity and approaching nearly 200 signatures. And then, of course, last week, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announcing the administration was closing loopholes in the Mexico City policy. Here with an update on all things life is our good friend, Dr. Andy Harris, congressman from the 1st District of Maryland. Dr. Harris, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Good to be with you, Tony.
So despite the fact that, you know, we have Nancy Pelosi and a anti-life majority in Congress currently, there are some good things happening. And here we're setting records, actually, with this discharge petition, where we now are just about 20 votes short, 20 signatures short of forcing a vote on the Born Alive Survivor Protection Act.
Absolutely. And as you and I have talked about, I mean, this should be common sense. You know, if a baby's born alive, you should do whatever you can to make sure that it lives. I mean, you know, the 14th Amendment really should be a guarantee for it once it's born. And then this is, you know, we have to push back against states like New York, which passed the law that basically would allow a baby to effectively be killed after birth after a botched abortion. And then Virginia, the attempt to do it, which fortunately didn't work.
Well, let's talk. I mean, and we're tracking this. I mean, what before I move on to the Mexico City policy, because that's what I want to talk about, because this is another positive development from this administration that's being criticized, of course. But the we actually have, I think, now four Democrat members of the House that have signed on to the discharge petition. What are you hearing among those on the other side of the political aisle on the Born Alive bill?
Well, the fact that we have four is actually tremendous progress because, well, you know, obviously pro-life Democrats are few and far between. But on this issue, I would hope that, again, these four will give courage to, you know, another 16, 17 or so that we will need in order to get to 218 and have a vote on this issue. Look, in total transparency, I don't understand why Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to vote on this issue. If she feels so strongly that, you know, that infants born alive should not be protected, then, you know, let's have a vote and let's put the votes up on the board. And I hope that my Democrat colleagues realize this is not extreme. In fact, the position against this is the extremist position in American politics right now.
Yeah, the polling shows that very clearly, Dr. Harris. And I mean, not that, of course, I can say this because I'm not worried that they're listening to the program. But to me, politically, it makes absolutely no sense for them to block this vote. I actually think it's hurting them by not allowing something as, you know, well, something that's over 75% of American support. It politically makes no sense for them unless they're completely in lockstep with the extreme liberal element of their party.
Oh, that's absolutely right, because this, of course, as you know, Tony, unfortunately, this bill doesn't ban abortion. It really doesn't speak at all to whether or not an abortion can or cannot take place. All it says is that if a baby's born alive, it's going to be protected under law. And this should be a no-brainer, even for people who believe in abortion rights. And I put it in quotes because, of course, I'm not sure anybody has a right to it, to kill another human being. But this has nothing to do with that. This is about taking care of a human being once it's born. And if society can't agree on that, we'd be in a very sad place.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Let's talk about what I really wanted to talk about was the Mexico City policy, the announcement, and you're on appropriations. You oversee the expenditure of U.S. dollars, taxpayer money. The Trump administration, you know, 72 hours after he took office, said he was reestablishing the Mexico City policy, which first came about 1984. President Ronald Reagan at a U.N. meeting there in Mexico City said, we are not going to fund organizations that either provide or promote abortion. The Secretary of State last week announcing that they're going to close loopholes, saying that subcontractors to these non-governmental organizations also have to comply with this prohibition. But some on the left are screaming that this is going to somehow affect their ability to provide medical care.
That's absolutely right. You know, reproductive health, when it includes abortion, is not about health at all. It's about, you know, killing a human being. And that's what you'll hear. Well, this is going to impair reproductive health in some way or other health. Look, any organization that wants to get money from the U.S. government, it's very simple. Don't participate in abortion in any way, shape, or form. Don't promote it as a birth control method. Don't work with organizations that promote it. Don't fund or so this last step was the shell game that went on was that the U.S. could send money to an organization that then could turn around and send money to an organization or fund an organization that would provide abortion. So this truly did eliminate a loophole. And now the Mexico City policy is tight. It's where it ought to be. No money should flow from the U.S. government to any organization that in any way is associated with abortion.
And again, this is one of those issues, as you pointed out, Dr. Harris, with the born alive. This is something, you've got more than, I mean, almost 90% of Americans are opposed to this concept that we would allow a born alive baby to either die or to have their life taken. Well, we're approaching very similar numbers when it comes to taxpayer funding of abortion. And this is what we're talking about here with Mexico City, saying we will not allow U.S. tax dollars to be spent to go to those organizations that either provide for or promote abortion. That's all it is.
That's right. And the other key thing and the reason why that percent is so high among Americans is this is overseas foreign aid tax dollars. So, you know, Americans are already biased against foreign aid. They think we send too much foreign aid overseas. And I think there would be really incensed to say, you know, of all the things we can send foreign aid for, you know, we can send it for food, we can send it for other things,
right.
But to send it to promote or pay for abortion is beyond the pale.
That's right. Absolutely right. Dr. Andy Harris, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day to join us.
Thank you.
Dr. Andy Harris, Congressman from Maryland's 1st Congressional District. By the way, you need to weigh in on the discharge petition. Call your member of Congress. Also, you can be a part of the End Birthday Abortion campaign. Go to TonyPerkins.com, find out how. All right?
Okay, don't go away. We're going to dissect the issues of the week coming up here in just a little bit with the expert panel here at the Family Research Council. That's coming up. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
Grandpa Jerry, what are you doing?
What? What does it look like I'm doing? I'm sitting on this bench enjoying my tea and reading the news.
You always tell me that I need to stand firm for faith, family, and freedom. Why aren't you standing?
Well, now with this new Stand Firm app, I can sit and stand at the same time. And if you got the Stand Firm app, you could learn something besides that garbage of peddling in public schools. You could listen to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, where Tony and leaders on the Hill and other culture influencers weigh in on current events. You can read FRC's latest publications and articles responding to what's going on in the news, like this.
Oh.
You can play trivia and earn points for free prizes. You can even access all of FRC's publications directly to sharpen your mind and give you the ability to discern the thoughts and intentions of the heart.
I can be a mind reader?
Kid, that's from the Bible, the richest piece of literature on God's green earth.
Can I see this stand up? Wow, this would keep me informed. Visit frc.org/app to download FRC's Stand Firm app. Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins. The website is tonyperkins.com. So glad to have you with us on this Thursday afternoon. Be sure and check out the website. There is a way for you to participate in the end birthday abortions. Send a message to Nancy Pelosi. Go to tonyperkins.com. All right. The five federal court districts that sit along the U.S.-Mexico border were the top five districts in the country for the number of defendants they convicted and sentenced to imprisonment in fiscal year 2018. This is according to data published by the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts. In other words, securing the border would help reduce crime. That, according to my next guest, who he loves to crunch the numbers, Terry Jeffrey, editor-in-chief of CNSNews.com. Terry, there you go again, crunching those numbers.
Hey, Tony, thanks for having me on the show. You know, these are some very obvious numbers that the government publishes every year, and I've been reporting on them for a long time. These are new numbers that came out from the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts for the most recent fiscal year, 2018, but they show a pattern that's been going on for a long time. The five U.S. court districts along the border, as you said, are by far the top districts for prosecuting criminals and prosecuting them for serious crimes. The numbers I used in this piece, these were people who were prosecuted in front of a federal district judge in a court on the border, convicted and sentenced to prison. There are other people who were merely fined. Other people were released on supervision. These are the people who actually did crimes serious enough that a federal judge says, you're going to jail, pal.
So what lesson do we learn from this data? Is it just that we have more aggressive prosecutors and tougher judges down there, or is it just the volume of the crime because of the porous nature of the border?
It's the volume of the crime because of the porous nature of the border. If you talk to assistant U.S. attorneys who work in these districts, they know this. In fact, assistant U.S. attorneys around the country, they all know this. If you want to be in a place that's very busy, go down to West Texas, South Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, or Southern California. And another part of this is, the real dynamic is this. The drug cartels, the alien smugglers, other types of criminals, they know that the U.S. border is not secure. They can make a lot of money by bringing contraband, whether it's people or drugs, across the border. There's a lot of crime that's associated with that, up to and including murder. And so there is a tremendous amount of crime, not only on the U.S. side of the border, but also on the Mexican side of the border, because we haven't secured it. And, you know, put this in perspective. There's a number I didn't put in my column. I've reported about it before. In the U.S. federal court system, you have the district courts where federal district judges who are confirmed by the United States Senate sit and watch the cases. But there's also a magistrate federal court system that was invented back in the early 1970s to deal with lesser federal offenses and to take the pressure off federal judges and jurisdictions where there is a heavy crime load. Well, 90% of the criminals convicted in federal magistrate courts in the latest year available, which is fiscal 2017, are in those same five districts along the border. In fact, in Arizona alone in 2017, there were 13,195 criminals convicted in magistrate court, another 11,240 in West Texas, which is the jurisdiction which last year had the most criminals, 7,126, who were convicted before a federal district judge. So, Tony, I mean, after the federal courts convicted more than 7,000 serious criminals and sent them to prison, there's another more than 11,000 criminals in West Texas that the magistrate courts had to deal with and convict.
Well, Terry, I have to ask you then a question that I think that is on the minds of most of our listeners out there. Is if this data is there, this is record, this is federal information, how can there be those here in Washington, D.C. that say we don't have a crime problem on our border?
It's absurd. You know, Tony, it's absolutely absurd. And in my column, I link to the sources. So people can go, they can look at the sources themselves. And the other source where I'm citing the magistrate judges, which I don't do in this column, but I report it from before and people can look up, it comes from the Office of the U.S. Attorneys. Every single year going back to 1959, the Office of the U.S. Attorneys has published an annual statistical report where they have similar data to that published by the courts themselves that show the same pattern in the long-term historical trend. The preponderance of federal crime takes place in the five districts along the border. And it really shows the negligence of our government. For years and years and years, they've known this is going on. People on both sides of the border are being victimized by crime, including by serious violent crime. And this is reflected in the caseload of the courts, and our government isn't doing anything about it. I would love to debate any liberal and Democrat who wants to talk about it. They don't want to debate these facts because they know they are true. And they're willing to pay this price and make the American people pay the price for the benefit that they think they derive from allowing illegal aliens to come across the border.
So, Terry, Jeffrey, based on these numbers, it looks like the president is not only justified under the law, but under the circumstances, he should be declaring a crisis on our border.
Well, there's no doubt a crisis, and I think our government needs to fix it, Tony. And the question is whether they have the will. Obviously, the liberals in Congress don't. The president does.
All right. Once again, Terry Jeffrey, very interesting article using the numbers. Thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us.
Thank you, Tony.
Folks, you can look at it yourself. Go to TonyPerkins.com. Again, these are government numbers, and he just puts them all together. Paints a pretty compelling picture. Certainly does. All right. Coming up next, we're joined by an expert panel from the Family Research Council, breaking down the issues of the week, religious liberty, life, the Southern Poverty Law Center. All of that coming up next. Don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
Picture it. Majestic beauty all around you. Wildlife, deep blue waters, glacial mountains, lush forests. Can you imagine the majesty of creation at every turn? Discover Alaska with FRC. You'll enjoy every moment of this unforgettable experience. Juno, accessible only by sea and air. Ketchikan and its impressive collection of Native American totem poles. Glacier Bay, a breathtaking wonder. All this, plus a behind-the-scenes look at what Family Research Council is doing in our nation's capital. You'll hear directly from FRC President Tony Perkins, General Jerry Boykin, and Michelle Bachmann. This is no ordinary vacation. You'll be vacationing with the FRC family and a lot of new friends. Be rejuvenated as we deepen our relationships with God and each other. Don't just get away. Get away with purpose on Family Research Council's Alaska Cruise, July 7th through 14th. Call 844-872-5155 to register today or visit us online at frc.org/Alaska.
Happy birthday to you.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy birthday, dear.
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Your email inbox is probably filled with a lot of free stuff these days. Free is good, but most of our email ends up being free spam. If you want a healthier diet in your inbox, add Tony Perkins' Washington Update newsletter to your email menu. This daily update from Family Research Council is our flagship publication, an update with the latest pro-family take on Washington's hottest issues. The update goes beyond the headlines and examines what is really going on in our culture and politics from a biblical perspective. Are evangelicals showing up at the polls? Are faith-based adoption providers persecuting same-sex couples? The left and the media love to answer these questions for you. Let FRC remove the spin and give you real answers with the Washington Update. To subscribe to this free daily newsletter and to subscribe to other free resources, go to frc.org/connect. That's frc.org/connect.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, TonyPerkins.com. All right. I'm going to bring in an expert panel of the Family Research Council. By the way, a lot of folks don't realize this unless you listen all the time, but the Family Research Council, which is the parent organization of Washington Watch, we have about 100 people on our team, close to it. Number of experts, PhDs, policy experts, folks that lobby on the Hill. So what you hear every day on the radio program generally is just me, but we've got I'm just the tip of the iceberg. The real stuff comes behind. And joining me in the studio to talk about some of the issues that took place this week, we're going to talk about religious liberty. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo earlier in the week attacked for being too Christian in his post as Secretary of State. You might recall we discussed on the program Representative Stephanie Borowitz out of Pennsylvania. She was on the program on Tuesday, creating a stir in the minds of some because she prayed in Jesus' name. Number of issues on the Hill this week, the Born Alive Abortion Survivor Protection Act, the Equality Act, and then today the Violence Against Women Act being voted on the House floor, and then, of course, the Southern Poverty Law Center. Now, joining me to break all this down, David Clawson, Research Fellow for Religious Freedom and Biblical Worldview here at the Family Research Council. Chris Gasek, Senior Fellow, Regulatory Policy, and Mary Beth Waddell, who is a Senior Legislative Assistant, and they join me now. David, Chris, Mary Beth, welcome.
Good to be here, Tony. Thank you.
David, I'm going to start with you. This week, Mike Pompeo, Secretary of State, actually was over the weekend last week. It's an attack. That's the only way I can describe it. Suggesting that because he's a Christian, an evangelical Christian, that somehow he's disqualified or unable to be Secretary of State.
Well, you're absolutely right, Tony. And this article is just the latest example of the left's growing hostility towards Christianity and public displays of faith, even beginning with the headline. And throughout that article, the suggestion is quite explicit that Secretary Pompeo's Christian beliefs are somehow subversive to the interest of American foreign policy. At one point in that article, the author seems to mock Secretary Pompeo's response to a question where he says that President Trump might have very well been raised up for such a time as this. And the writer says that that comment's perhaps the most revelatory of any remark that Pompeo has made since becoming Secretary of State. Really? That's a common Christian belief, that God providentially raises up leaders at certain moments. That's something that Christians have always believed. So for the New York Times, the real story, the thing that really bothers them is that Secretary Pompeo is a committed Christian. These beliefs are mainstream evangelical beliefs. Specifically, millions of Christians hold to a similar eschatology that includes a form of the rapture, a future for Israel. And one other thing I'd say is the fact that these are well-known beliefs, ones that Pompeo has held publicly for years.
You know, I would argue, David, that when it comes to foreign policy, and especially where the troubled parts of the world, where you have the Islamic faith, where you have people who actually believe, you know, the teachings of the Quran, that someone who understands the value and the significance of faith is actually better equipped to deal with it. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the last decade and a half, two decades really, we've been missing it on our foreign policy, especially in the Middle East. I think because Pompeo understands how faith is at the core of one's being, that actually puts him in a better spot.
Oh, absolutely, Tony. I think it was a Pew Research poll came out recently that said that 84% of people around the world affiliate with religion. 84%. So if anything, Pompeo's faith is an asset, not a liability. And specifically in this article, which seems to go after his position on Israel, Secretary Pompeo's Christian worldview, that's going to help him see that everybody is made in the image of God, Israelis, Palestinians, and that's going to motivate him to pursue a foreign policy that respects the dignity of everything or of everyone. So that's a good thing. His worldview is a good thing.
Chris Gasek?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is a really key point that you've hit on, because the foreign policy establishment in this town and, you know, sort of New York, that whole sort of tranche of people who are, you know, Council on Foreign Relations, all the sort of the elites, right? They're totally secular. And so they have no kind of insight into people who, let's say you're dealing with the president of Egypt, al-Sisi, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, he's not a Muslim Brotherhood guy, but he's still a very devoutly religious person. What is his worldview, right? If you can't sort of interact with people at this level of kind of at least respecting sort of the theistic side of
that's why I think they miss it.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Because they don't take them serious.
Right. They don't take it seriously, and therefore when you see some, you know, you get these sort of ridiculous things like, you know, people not taking ideology seriously. But if you go back to like Vietnam, you know, LBJ's offering Ho Chi Minh, you know, to build like the TVA in Vietnam, right? It's right. You see what I'm saying, though? It's like thinking like a Western, you know, a liberal Democrat from Southwest Texas. And no, these people have a completely different, you know, frame of mind.
Mary Beth, senior legislative assistant here at the Family Research Council, busy week on Capitol Hill. Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act discharge petition going out on Tuesday. Record number of signatures already on that petition. The Equality Act. We've got the also the Violence Against Women Act being voted on today. So, kind of sum up what's been happening on Capitol Hill this week.
There's been a lot, as you said, and, you know, as you talked to Dr. Harris earlier, you had the discharge petition that was filed by Whip Scalise and Representative Wagner. It already has 198 signatures, including three Democrats, so about 20 more are needed. You know, they're still pushing to get more members to sign. They have until the end of Congress, you know, to get that done. But hopefully that will be done sooner rather than later, given how rapid it's been able to get 198. The Equality Act and VAWA are both very similar, in they're both bad bills.
Mm-hmm. Top priorities for Nancy Pelosi.
Yes, both indeed. You know, the Equality Act is H.R. 5, and so that was specially reserved for her. She wanted that to be something she championed. They just had a hearing on that in Judiciary this week. They'll have another hearing next week in Ed and Labor. And the witnesses that even the Republicans brought were from the left side of the aisle, showing that this isn't just issues that we as Christians and we as conservatives have.
Right.
And those issues are, if you blur the lines between what is a man, what is a woman, that has very detrimental effects to women, to children, to the society at large. And you have very strong leftist liberal feminists who believe that. And so it's, we've got really great allies in this fight.
Yeah, it's really fascinating to see this, that the feminists see what's being driven by the radical transgender movement as an attack on women.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we had Peter Sprigg on yesterday talking about the Equality Act. Essentially, folks, what it does is it puts into the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it puts in gender identity and
sexual orientation.
And sexual orientation, mm-hmm. those two. So it's like a federal, what we call SOGI. And that creates a host of problems. But as you said, it's drawing fire from the left as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Small Business Administration has specific loans that it gives to women entrepreneurs to, quote, level the playing field, you know, for women. And now those would be open to men. You
who
know,
say they're women.
Yes.
Or at least for business purposes feel like a woman.
Yes, who claim to be women.
When you open this up, Chris, and I know you've been a part of government regulation in that field of attorney work. I mean, there's no way to keep control of this. This is Pandora's box. I mean, you open this thing up and who knows what's going to come out.
No, I mean, this is a very – Pandora's box is a great way to describe it. It's – they don't know – they can't, for example, define the number of genders, for example, right? I mean, this is – you can't even – I mean, how is a business supposed to operate under circumstances like that? They need –
you never know if you're going to get caught up
exactly.
in some kind of trap.
Right.
And, of course, you weaponize – like the Employment Opportunity Commission will be used as a weapon to go after businesses. I mean, and what really amazes me is that we see big business siding with this agenda, and it's going to come back and it's going to bite them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and one of the things about big business to always remember is that they think, and in some sense they're true, is that they think that they can master the government and regulation because they have teams of lawyers in these places. Their real competition, the entrepreneurs, the small guys, don't have these big, you know, departments of government.
Yeah, but even there,
they're
not going to be able to lawyer up. I know you're wanting to get some of your friends' jobs out there, you know, as a lawyer, going to help out your friends. They can't lawyer up enough to head off this agenda.
Oh, it's a delusion.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's those smaller and medium-sized businesses that are going to be hurt the most.
Yeah.
You know, it's this corporate push is from the big companies.
Right. But even they will, as they lawyer up, it's going to cost the consumer more because ultimately the price tag is going to be paid by the consumer. But David Clawson, this also is an attack on religious freedom.
Oh, absolutely. And that we have barely even touched on that. But in the wording of this bill, the Equality Act, it specifically says that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 shall not provide a claim concerning or a defense to claim under. Basically, the Equality Act will trump the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. So the unless you're on board with the left's definition of these contested categories of sexual orientation or gender identity, you will now find yourself on the opposite side of the law. And so Christians who hold to an orthodox position of marriage and gender will all of a sudden be holding views that are on the wrong side of the law. So the religious liberty challenges here are they're very dangerous.
That is a major, major revelation when you look at that in terms of a paradigm shift of priorities in the nation, where we've gone from having religious freedom as our first freedom being, you know, practically spelled out in the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, now being trumped by gender identity and sexual orientation.
Yeah. And RFRA is the shorthand for the law is actually what was used by Little Sisters of the Poor to not be forced to provide contraceptives.
Right.
RFRA itself is just a balancing test. It doesn't mandate that you're beholden to religious beliefs. It says if the government is going to burden religious belief, then it has to do so towards a compelling interest in the most narrow means possible. It's not even a dictate. It's just a balancing test that they're saying no balance at all. We've tipped the scales.
You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, special expert panel here of the FRC team. David Clawson, Research Fellow for Religious Freedom and Biblical Worldview here at FRC. Chris Gasich, Senior Fellow, Regulatory Policy. And Mary Beth Waddell, she is a Senior Legislative Assistant here at the Family Research Council. Chris, before we run out of time, I want to go to you and one of the areas that you focus on. It's been a really bad week for the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Well, I mean, it's about the third or fourth in a row. I mean,
And is that a tear that I see emerging?
Yeah, right. Maybe a crocodile tear. But it's no, I mean, and I think it's been capped off by Senator Cotton in a way sort of saying the emperor has no clothes at the IRS. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that I would sort of find really interesting is that when you work in this town and you sort of think about things the way you're always thought about, it takes a lot to sort of come outside the sort of the normal framework and say, what is that, right? And so when you look at an organization like the SPLC that resembles, you know, it's more like a hedge fund than a nonprofit, and everybody says, well, you know, you could blah, blah, blah. And he's sort of coming along and saying, like, you may have some sort of variance in terms of what nonprofits are like. But that's so far outside.
Well, sitting on $500 million in funds that they've collected.
Well, with all kinds of overseas accounts and money and just.
And the curtain being pulled back with Morris Dees being fired, Richard Cohen resigning, and the fact that employees, former employees, saying it's nothing more than a con game.
Right. I mean, so I think you have the whole whole perspective here of maybe it's you know, we can't. The left could sort of say, well, they deserve the benefit of the doubt even though they had all this money. But when you sort of see these internal revelations, it's almost like, no, you really have to sort of go in there and look from top to bottom. And you know, the IRS has to do this. They could perform these, you know, these sort of analyses of the code.
And then a group of 67 conservative organizations, of which FRC was one of them, calling on, you know, big business and the media to stop using this standard that the SPLC created, given now that we know that they're nothing more than a cesspool of bigotry and racism.
Yeah, and so their brand, that sort of element of, you know, sort of what they sort of call their sort of core to their business has really sort of taken a hit, because if you can't trust the organization for having internal integrity in areas like race, then how can you be sort of, you know, relying on them as an arbiter for these things?
So your prediction, does the media stick with them?
I think that some will break away. I think we're going to have erosion, right? It's just going to be, you know, bit by bit, but it's going to be harder. And I think some people will break away, and some people maybe will get some social media companies that will start to take another look.
Mary Beth, to you, does the House pass the discharge petition? Do they get the 218 votes, signatures?
I think it's possible. I do think that it's within reach.
All right. David Clawson, you're going to have to hold on until next time. We're out of time. Folks, thanks so much for joining us. I want to thank my panel, David Clawson, Chris Gasich, and Mary Beth Waddell. Until next time, I leave you with the encouraging words of the Apostle Paul, which he says in Ephesians 6, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you have taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.